fought it very, very strongly. We think we'll have to look at the challenges of the government ideology there. If we go to the next one, enable independent, cost-effectiveness and quality review of both public and private education, health and social ways, we agree very, very strongly with that. We agree with it intrinsically, but we also believe, honorable members, that we need increasing comparative analysis between how cost-effectively independent education is offered compared to public education. This provides a very good internal benchmark, and it's not that we're going to compare apples with dogs by comparing rich independent schools with poor public schools. There are many independent schools that cater for the poor that use very little resources in delivering education. In certain areas that have huge poverty manifested in those areas. And we want to compare those situations with public schools. So we agree with this. However, and this is not however to say it mustn't be done, but these reviews are complex. And we've learned in South Africa that the moment we increase the demand for a certain area of analytical work, like monitoring and evaluation, it does suddenly produce many experts in the area whose ability is very dubious. They define as experts, they may even belong to associations that anoint them as experts, but that doesn't mean that the capacity they have to execute this methodology in its required technical rigor is commensurate to the task. And we would caution that if we do this, we must do it properly, with due rigor, otherwise we would arrive at conclusions that are not going to be helpful. The next one is, when introducing and terminating conditional grants, the department must introduce mandatory systematic process for designing, planning, individual conditional grants, ensure there's an independent evaluation. We fully support these recommendations. The next one, government should make the criteria for dividing grant allocations transparent, continue to emphasize the importance of non-financial data. We fully support this recommendation. If you go to the next one, on reforming conditional fiscal transfers, national departments must make accounting for delivery a prerequisite for conditional grants. We agree with this, but to repeat the point I made earlier, we continue to be faced with a key challenge regarding conditional grants. This is the challenge. How do you reconcile the emphasis on accounting for delivery on the one hand with the fact that you cannot prejudice beneficiaries who fall within the jurisdiction of underperforming public administration, on the other hand? We're not raising this as an excuse. We're raising this as a key challenge to fiscal policy or public finance policy, and it's important that public finance policy here converges with delivery, service delivery, and the impact of decisions on service delivery. This means that sanction for poor or suboptimal delivery cannot be a withholding or reallocation of funds. What it requires in theory is that we have to support, assist, apply sanction in a directed way. But that, honorable members, then raises the question of capacity. In the National Department, we say, in acknowledging that, we've got to make sure that we create the capacity that's able to intervene, assist, problem solve in a manner that frees up that allocation to achieve its objective. We are therefore obliged to balance these two considerations. Next one, budget allocation process must follow grant framework specifically. We agree with that. With regard to the other recommendations, Honorable Chair, with regard to Chapter 2, we addressed one set of recommendations there. With the other recommendations on social assistance during a period of fiscal stress, the DBA does not have substantive comments on these recommendations. I've indicated it's got to do with our competence and the impact of this in the area of work, so we don't have substantive comments there. With regard to Chapter 3, recommendations on the performance of conditional grants and transfers, I have spoken to that recommendation. With regard to the other two, on local government revenue improvement strategies and fiscal stress, and reforming local government equitable share, we do not have substantive comments in that area. And then, with regard to Chapter 3, continued, regionalizing municipal services, the case of electricity distribution industry in South Africa, we don't really have substantive contributions there, including Chapter 4, recommendations on intergovernment fiscal issues and urban public transport. Honorable Chairperson, I've spoken very fast. I hope not too fast. I hope we've done justice to what's expected of us and I conclude there, I think, within the time you've allocated me. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you very much to the Department of Basic Education. Straightforward. All the members, time for questions. Just one thing, not actually linked to specific to a grant or to recommendations, but one thing that we must have in our minds, and that's what I pick up when I do my constituency work and visit schools three times a year, is school transport, learner transport, after school hours to sport events in rural areas. For a school in Lelyfontein to attend a sport activity in Karkans that is 55 kilometers and back is 750 rand. 85% of the people living there is unemployed. There's only one service provider is making its price. Because the other closest town is Springbok, 110 kilometers from there, where bus services are running. And this is not only in my province in the Northern Cape, it will be in Eastern Cape, in mountainous areas, KZN, Mpumalanga, and so we can carry on, the eastern part of the Free State. And this is a serious thing for the future, because it's building up. And when a school doesn't have that financial resources to pay the service provider running the bus service, those learners won't get the opportunity to participate in the sports, department of sports programs, education regarding sports, etc. That will be the result. And we will have to correct it now, before it's too late. I spoke to the HOD of Education in Northern Cape. They are formalizing something that will go the route and eventually end up at the Budget Council. But I'm just sensitizing on that. The second one is quintiles. How does the school fall into quintile 5 when 85% of the people living in Garish is unemployed? High school Garish? And the primary school in Garit, J.J. Lambert. I'm looking for the person who did that evaluation. I'll take that person with, on my expense, to Garit to go and have a look and see, but how did you get to your answer to put it in a quintile 5? It's impossible. I'm telling you now. It's not only, again, in my province. It will happen in other provinces as well. The honorable members can speak for themselves. It's a serious issue. It's a very serious issue. Honorable members, time for questions. Let me take the hand, Honorable Mashile. Bella. In that order.
Thanks, Jefferson. I think we just also need to appreciate the DG for having burnt midnight oil to actually respond to the necessary reports that you wanted him to respond to, and also to really say that we do understand and that the department is having challenges with the wage negotiations that's happening that has led to a strike, and we hope that the Department of Public Service Administration and the unions would regain their strength to go back into the chamber and then finalize this particular matter within a very short space of time, because it is not the government that is paying the price, or the unions, but it's ordinary people on the ground that are paying the price, and we're worried about that. Chair, I just want to really check, because what I was made to understand on the fiscal consolidation was that it means cutting spending, tightening the belt. But then how would this affect the school feeding systems that we have? And also the in a nutshell the access to schooling. Because if we have to cut spending and generally moving into the block grants, there is a likelihood that more funds may be spent on books and school stationaries, and we may be paying prices on the school feeding and health impeding access to schooling. How are we really going to ensure that, understand that you may be putting the norms or whatever, but I mean, if you are working from one basket, there is compromises that are going to happen. But one wouldn't like to see the compromise being on access to schooling, because we are all trying to get our country to be literate, and The more people get to school, the better. But while we are tightening the belt, as recommended by SSC, if that is implemented, how are we going to ensure that really we don't impede on access to schooling? The other issue which I just wanted to raise is, when we entertain the block grants, the early childhood development, because as far as I'm concerned, it's critical, although I've implied on it on the fiscal consolidation, but also on the block grants. How are we going to ensure that that does not get compromised? Funds being taken to other things, because we are endlessly building new infrastructure at schools, although is that we are forgetting to maintain them. But the introduction of block grants is just going to actually increase the problem, because now funds can just be switched around. And then just simply to also add to what the chairperson has raised, because I really could not understand why I did not have any substantive comment on the public transport. I just could not understand it. Probably we're thinking too much into this thing than what the department is thinking. But at the end of the day is that we have the scholar transport, and public transport also plays a key role in the attendance of children to school, and even though that it is not what you are managing, but it's got a huge impact on your efficiency at school. Then what happens with the public transport should be of serious interest to you. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm not going to ask anything about the altering of the FSC. I'm going to page 15 of the first briefing. Page 15. Is the challenge. The police say not enough capacity to monitor the implementation of the program, but a bid has been submitted in this respect. It's only challenges which are there. What is the solution? I meant to say it would be good to have the challenges presented, but what is the solution, the proposal of the solution? Around page 18, the challenge is like a non-availability of school plans, and also another bullet, prolonged procurement process.
if this thing has been identified, is there any plan with the department is having in order to minimize this type of non-availability of plans and the prolonged procurement process? Page number 20. Talking about it in already, we are saying the 500 Naredi students. I would like to have a breakdown in the provinces so that I'll be able to go to the nearest school, which I know in my constituency that no, this is one of the Naredi schools. Another one there is the, it will also include the provision of textbooks for learners, mobile, what I would like to ask, where we're seeing the mobile science laboratory, how many do we have this mobile? Because it can be just a statement that no, because it always talks in the future tense that it will be. This, we want to see if the thing is happening. Number 21. I'll leave that one because on the conclusion, page number 22. You are talking about, this is talking about the desire. Let me read this statement. The department, despite the challenge, there has been significant progress in respect of the implementation of the National School Nutrition Program, as well as there is. Now, the department will continue to support the the program achieves the desired. I want to see that we're having this target here, what we've done, the number, a certain number, but my desired goal is this one. It is not just a shipping statement. Thanks.
Sorry, it was quite I'm still trying to get my head around a lot of the presentation. Firstly, the whole analysis in terms of inequality, I failed to see. The presenter said that something about how the biggest increase in spending in education is in after-hours tuition, which is a direct result of high income inequality. I mean, you're speaking about income inequality as if it was the cause of our education problems. The problem is not that certain sections of our population have income and certain sections don't. The problem is that there are sections that don't. My concern is that if the analysis is that inequality is the problem, then it becomes something of a fig leaf for allowing things like centralization and actually obscures the real problem, which is that there's a whole lot of people in South Africa that don't have particularly high levels of income, and that the education department and the way we approach education in South Africa now is not giving those people equality in terms of education. That perhaps that doesn't directly affect their response to the FSC. The one thing which perhaps is relevant is the discussion on block grants. And I'm trying to get my head around it. The idea of poverty sensitivity in the education component. I mean, the education component is very simple right now. It's the number of school-going children you have, and it's weighted extremely heavily. It's actually the majority of the provincial equitable share. I don't understand how the department is suggesting we could introduce any kind of poverty sensitivity there that would have a real effect on that, considering that, that we are already giving the departments, the provinces, huge amounts of money based on the number of school children they have. I don't think there's any way we could reform the formula to make it more sensitive or progressive, as the department says. Treasury mentioned yesterday that they would they would bring some numbers on with what proportion of their equitable share the provinces were spending on education. It would be interesting to get those at some point, because the second part of the department's critique is that some departments are not allocating sufficient amounts to basic education. So it would be interesting to see if the data does confirm that. Then the third part of the critique is that the allocations within the education budgets are not sound. Again, can we get some examples of provinces where those allocations aren't sound, where it's not working, and how the department would propose fixing those problems without prejudicing those provinces where it is working? And then I understand the committee, I missed a meeting on this in March this year, did a session with the FSC which covered their cost of norms proposal. I also understand that this is a proposal which I think is around 10 years old already, and has at various points been rejected by the Treasury. What I don't understand, and I apologize for not making the meeting in March, but it's the interaction between the block grant proposal and the proposal around cost of norms. Because cost of norms didn't come up yesterday at all, and now the Department of Education is linking that to the block grant. And I don't understand how changing the formula in terms of a cost of norms approach would affect something like a block grant, which, from what I heard yesterday, is a much more simple proposal. If they do interact and they are related, then I would appreciate a lesson in that. This proposal from the FFC that the departments need to enable independent reviews of cost effectiveness and quality. I suspect, I might be wrong, but I suspect that the department has misread it. I don't think the agency is suggesting there needs to be a comparative review necessarily between the public and the private sector. I think it could simply be an independent cost effectiveness review of the public spending by the department. So I think the analysis of that, and rather the qualifying of that in the position, is perhaps a red herring. The question is probably more relevant to ask. The more relevant question to ask, rather, is what reviews has the department done? You acknowledge that there may be problems in the type of reviews, and you spoke about how they're complex to conduct, but regardless of that, have you done any reviews of the cost effectiveness of your spending and the quality of your spending in the department, notwithstanding the problems with those kinds of reviews? And then there's a general view which is summed up in this recommendation by the FFC that accounting for delivery must be a prerequisite for conditional grants. And it's the idea that if a province is failing, withdrawing the funds won't necessarily help that failure if the failure is linked to a capacity problem, which is granted. But you still need some degree of sanction. Now, one could suggest that if provinces are failing continually, instead of withdrawing the funding, we need to be holding those managers to account. And if provincial managers aren't being held to account, then some responsibility needs to fall onto national managers. So I acknowledge that we can't cut funds as a form of sanction, but perhaps we need to hold management much more to account. Chair, I apologize, I wasn't very clear in many of those questions, but perhaps the department can pick out a few things to respond to. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Maris. Honourable Malanela.
Thanks, Chair, and welcome the presentation by the teacher. stuff in the first slide just to get an understanding. On the National Nutrition, School Nutrition Program, I just want to understand whether the program does cover for infrastructure. Because you have a situation where these programs are introduced in schools, but there is no infrastructure. There are no kitchens, there's absolutely nothing. And communities are made to be on their own and see how they create the infrastructure. And in some areas, because of the ruralness and the poor condition of those families, they are unable to do so. And there's no assistance that provincial departments are providing on those matters. Mm. I just want to understand the extent to which these grants then cover infrastructure. Or any other infrastructure other funding that deals with the infrastructure in relation to the school nutrition program. The other clarity seeking question around the Nalid is, it's for how long will these schools remain under that program? Is there any continuous expansion, or it will remain to the 400-500 for how long? And to what extent are all the schools finally will have to be at the same level with those Nalidi schools in the country, if there's any plan towards that. The issue that you've raised about the provinces not allocating sufficient funds to basic education, it will be very important just to understand which provinces and to what extent. And the issue of the insufficient funding and budgeting to those, the implication it has. Because year in and year out, we are dealing with a challenge where the Department of Education, especially in the province, is having year in and year out unauthorized expenditure. And this unauthorized expenditure is as a result of the insufficient budget, especially in relation to personnel, where they had to spend money that they're not budgeted for. And this process, and when you engage them, they said, no, the budget allocated to them is insufficient. And we've got a goal that we've set ourselves as government by 2014, we want to see a clean audit. How do you achieve that clean audit when year in and year out departments are having unauthorized expenditure as a result of the insufficient budget or allocation of budget into those departments? To the extent to which that is true, it's another matter, because I'm not sure that the extent to which that is correct, that is true. Because there might be some wasteful, because at the same time, of course, why they are complaining about insufficient budget, there's a lot of wastages, there's a lot of wasteful expenditures in the process. So you're not sure the extent to which it is true that there's insufficient budget, or there's no proper management of the budget itself. So if you can just get an indication in relation to that. And then the issue that Honorable Marshall is very critical about public transport, because scholar transport just transport a very small section of kids. The majority of children are using public transport. And therefore, public transport is very key in the transportation of learners. And therefore, Department of Education should have a high interest in that matter. Not only in relation to kids, but in relation to educators as well. The mobility of educators to attend to schools, it's some of them dependent mainly on the public transport. So therefore, it has a huge impact, the functionality, the effectiveness, and the efficiency of the system. It has got a huge impact into the work of the Department of Education. And therefore, the department should have a high interest in that matter. Thanks.
Thank you to the honourable member. We also welcome your honourable Guni, sitting here on my right-hand side, and there at the back, honourable Blenzana. At the chairperson's meeting this morning, we also said the NCOP will do things differently on a series of issues, matters. This is part of it, where we engage and invite the chairpersons and members of other committees to come and attend these type of engagements with the FSC and other departments on spending for the future, and likely next week when we deal with appropriations on the quarterly spending on of conditional grants. So that makes the role of this committee more important. You are welcome to respond. Just one thing that slipped my mind, and that is high schools in my constituency have classrooms for science, laboratories, but there's no equipment. They can do the theoretical side of it in a textbook, but they can't do it in practice. And the one doesn't speak to the other one. So there's a missing link. And we will have to address this. Because you can pass grade 12, but you get outside, you haven't done the practical thing. It doesn't mean much. Just make a note of that, please. Thank you. You may respond.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. I'll answer the questions in the order that they've been asked, and there's been many questions, so I'm not going to speak in detail to all of them.
You've got time.
I've got time.
You've got time.
Okay, then I will speak in detail to all of them. Look, the question on scholar transport which was raised, and a number of members raised this, and it seems that my comment elicited a perception that we're not interested in scholar transport. We are very interested in it. We've got a program on scholar transport. We've got a whole set of interventions. It's part of our strategic plan. What I was asked to do today was to respond to a set of technical recommendations by the FSC. As we look at the recommendations made by them in relation to capital spending, the National Land Transport Act, public transport responsibilities, urban municipalities, conduct a review of costs, and so forth, we're saying in terms of our competence and our expertise, that doesn't fall directly within our ability to comment. It doesn't mean we're not interested in scholar transport. We're very, very interested in its impact on us very fundamentally. To the extent that it impacts on us, we've been engaging very strongly with the Treasury and the Department of Transport. And indeed, at the last cabinet report, based on our presentation, there's an agreement that through a bilateral between DBE and Department of Transport, and then including Treasury, we need to look at these issues of solar transport. As you've indicated, Chair, we're sitting on the receiving end of inexorable escalation of costs. It's inexplicable. We're facing that consequence. We're sitting with provincial procurement systems where public transport is paid for, which just don't make sense to us at all. So we're sitting with those issues that we're solving. But the recommendations in the FSC and their technical content is not something we feel we're able to comment on. So I just wanted to clarify that issue and confirm to honourable members that it is absolutely critical to us here. The point you raised about transporting learners in rural areas to sporting events is a huge problem. We've got to deal with not only the location of the school to deal with scholar transport, but you put your finger on an important issue, that you know, learners still have to go to sporting events in addition to how they get to school, and we've got to address this. So this is one of our major interventions in our action plan that's got to do with scholar transport and how that's located within a broader strategy of the location of schools, of hostels, and all those things coming together to deal with the question of scholar transport. Procurement issues apply to that as well. And I agree with you, it's a major problem for the future. It's unsustainable the way these things are going, and it must be addressed urgently. With regard to the quintiles, they are under review at the moment, and we've already implemented a change to them in that, given our experience and given the way poverty is distributed, we've collapsed quintiles 1, 2, and 3 into one common quintile for the purpose of allocation of funding, for the purposes of no-fee schools, etc. Because we believe there wasn't much separated there. We've left quintile 4 and 5 with revised criteria. In the situation you explaining, Honourable Chair, clearly there our right to appeal must apply, and we need to make sure it is dealt with properly.
I did appeal.
Okay.
and I delivered it personally by hand in Kimberley.
Excellent. There was another question around whether we've done reviews and so forth. I'll speak to that in detail. But one of the big reviews we did was indeed on how the funding norms are implemented. A very, very detailed, rigorous evaluation was done. And in that, we found that this question of the appeals is not being administered properly. There were a number of problems with relation to the administration of the norms and the policy. And we've now engineering solutions to fix those in very specific terms. And then in terms of science labs, you know, classrooms and equipment, there's a number of problems that fall into that category, one of which the Honorable Chair has put his finger on. We've got different budget schemes for supplying a lab and a different scheme for supplying the equipment and the chemicals. And what tends to happen is those two aren't coordinated. You end up with one without the other. We're trying to integrate that and making progress in relation to that. So that's the one area of intervention. The other area is that we've just published now infrastructure norms, which integrates not just the building of school buildings, but integrates into it the provision of libraries, specialist classrooms, laboratories, and the contents of those laboratories, ICT labs, and so forth. So again, through that, we intend to address this problem. Let me go to the next set of questions. Our spending cuts affect school...
excuse me, referring to the laboratories, can you forward that directive to us?
Sure.
Will assist us when we visit school.
Absolutely. So we'll make a note that the norms and standards for infrastructure, Mr. Padiachi, we can get that to the committee. In terms of the next set of questions, how spending cuts will affect school feeding and access to schooling, Honourable Member, that's an important question. In the MTF, we've got an increase in school feeding, school nutrition. Secondly, it's a conditional grant, so it's protected. When we responded to the FSC's recommendation around consolidation, we made the point that we understand the spirit of what they're saying is that we must protect, you know, spending to the vulnerable. And indeed, our reading of that is that the school nutrition, which has proven to be a very successful intervention of government, will be protected. So that's our understanding of that. So we don't anticipate any cut in school nutrition. It's been a highly successful program. It's made a huge difference on the ground in relation to access to schooling. In terms of redistribution, it's had a huge impact. And also in terms of mitigating the burden of disease, it's had a major impact. So certainly that is how we understand it. In terms of block grants, you know, the Honourable Member asked, will that affect, you know, allocations in terms of what needs to go to education if everything is in one basket? We believe that risk is there, and we've pointed to that risk. The question is, when one develops a policy, education a budget policy or education expenditure policy, it's always necessary to strike a balance with how prescriptive one is in relation to allocation and how much of freedom one allows. Prescription, we found over the years, is helpful, but it does create other problems in provinces if you're simultaneously giving provinces the discretion to make decisions based on needs and priorities. In an ideal world, if the spirit and letter of our constitution is followed, we want to see a situation where all provinces make decisions based on realities and the best interests of the population. And that's what we intend to achieve in terms of policy around budgets and allocations and so forth. But the Honourable Member's question does contain a risk. That risk is there. But we believe that in addition to budget policy, there's a huge monitoring initiative on behalf of the National Treasury in terms of allocations. There's a huge initiative on our part on behalf of in terms of monitoring. Ms. Gladys Modise, which is sitting behind me here, is a director in the department, and her sole responsibility is to monitor provincial budgets. And where there is that problem, we pick it up. We raise it with the provinces, raise it with Treasury in order to solve. We've also created bilaterals between Treasury and DBE to monitor on an ongoing basis spending and allocations in provinces. So again, we're saying there's checks and balances. The same applies to ECD in terms of your question around block grants. The question obviously arises constantly when we deal with this matter. It's about whether decisions for allocation is causing the problem, or whether the size of the envelope is causing the problem, or whether it inefficiencies in the system that's causing the problem. The answer is that it's generally a combination of those, and it varies over time. In some instances, we have bad decisions around allocation in certain years. In other years, it improves in a province. So one can't take 1 year and say this is the situation, which points to a culprit, which points to a problem. When we speak about policy and the recommendations by the FFCs about policy, we've got to take a long-term view of what the trends are in relation to that. So when we submit figures about allocation, it's important for honorable members to take into account that you can't look at 1 year's pattern and say, right, there's a problem in this problem. We've got to look at it over a period of time to see whether there's change and whether it's affected by certain conditions. Again, the honorable member asked about public transport. I responded to that. The next set of questions around slide 15, but not enough capacity, and then slide 18, not availability of school plans. You know, we made statements. We're not making any recommendations. I want to direct the honorable member to slide 19, where we then move from the statements to the intervention. And those are interventions that are being implemented at the moment. So the statements were made as part of the diagnosis, and then we speak about intervention, which is not intent or wishes, it's concrete. We're speaking about dealing with the procurement problems in terms of, you know, transversal tenders. We're speaking about on-site support, and those are concrete interventions. In terms of Dinaledi, a breakdown by province will indeed, in providing the norms, will provide that document as well, honorable member. Mobile classrooms and laboratories, how many? Again, we'll provide a list of numbers. But in addition, honorable member, you must link this one to the infrastructure norm. Because there we say the mobile labs and mobile libraries are short-term interventions. The long-term interventions are to build that in the school. And what the infrastructure norms provide for is that. In relation to slide 22, we'd like to see numbers. Honorable member is absolutely right there. What we've done in the presentation to keep it brief is to make the high-level statement. All of these are backed up by detailed documents. So we'll provide those detailed documents which speaks to where we are and where we want to go to. I think that covers the honorable member's question. So the next set of questions around basically the analysis we've provided, a lot of them, and where, you know, that takes us in terms of our responses. The honorable member raised the question around income inequality and suggested that we are implying that it's a cause which is almost immutable and that, you know, we almost fatalistically accepting that is the reality and that will affect whether or not we can change things. Honorable members suggest that the solution lies in making sure that those who are poor get more. Now, the point we've made around income inequality is covered extensively in development literature. It's not our point. In fact, there's nowhere in the world where economic fiscal policy, no matter which part of the ideological spectrum the country is located itself in, does not speak about redistribution as a key element of development. It's shown empirically through studies done over many, many, many years, unless you explicitly address income inequality, you're not going to have economic development. In addition, literature done throughout the world in many different contexts around education shows that the primary mediator of education outcomes is economic status, and linked to that, income inequality. So it's not fatalistic, it's a reality that's there. In real life, it plays itself out as follows, that as much as we allocate money to poor learners, what richer parents can do is to buy tuition, and that supports the achievement of those learners. It affects the labor market, it affects teachers, it's structural. We can't deny it affects the labor market. It affects the preparedness of teachers to teach in public schools. It impacts then on the achievement of poor learners, and in a society that seeks to be meritocratic, it affects, you know, outcomes that education has. And therefore, one can't deny in developing policy and intervention that you've got to deal with that issue very, very strongly. So no matter which country one is in, education policy is very strongly focused on that. So we're saying that when you deal with fiscal policy in this country, one of the fundamental issues one has got to address in developing policy, including education finance policy, is to acknowledge the reality of income inequality. And income inequality, when I say acknowledge it, I mean not simply progressivity in funding the poor and making available to the poor, but also looking at redistribution measures. So our policy in terms of education financing is such that for non-personal expenditure, we provide 7 times more for poor learner compared to a non-poor learner. There's a progressivity that flows from this provision. But notwithstanding that, because of high income inequality, the impact of that progressivity is limited. So again, in fiscal policy, that is an important reality. In terms of the block grants and the point we made about poverty sensitivity in the equitable share formula, and the Honourable Member raised that as a significant point in relation to our contribution. Again, this has been a long debate in this country about the poverty sensitivity of the equitable share formula. The Honourable Members, if the equitable share formula currently accounts for number of learners in a province. So it's true, Eastern Cape, which is a poor province with a high population, has got more learners, so they get more money. But per learner, the Eastern Cape, in terms of equitable share, will give the same amount as it gives to Gauteng to any other province. The question we've been trying to deal with is this question, that from a cost point of view, the challenges you're confronted with in poor areas is greater than that you confront with in non-poor areas. For 2 main reasons. One is that the extent of interventions that you need to apply need to be stronger. And secondly, your ability to raise funding in poor areas is much more limited. So that's the point that's been on the agenda in the debate constantly, that in terms of the equitable share formula, it's true that we allocate per learner, but there's no poverty sensitivity within that that drives it. In a context of high income inequality, it raises a policy challenge. Why we steered away from it in the past is that nobody denied that reality before. Why we steered away from it, and this has been in conversation with the Treasury, the FNC, and everyone else, is that we haven't quite worked out how, what one does with the additional money you give to poor learners, because the schools that poor learners go to have reduced capacity. That's the problem that we're dealing with. But that doesn't mean we mustn't acknowledge the importance of this point as a critical issue. So, again, there, you know, the question is about the data. Treasury said they'll supply what provinces are spending. I've added here that when we look at that data in terms of what provinces are allocating, please let's do it within a multi-year horizon so we don't draw conclusions on 1 year. I've made a point that allocations within government are not sound. Again, there, if you look at my slide, I said that there are certain ways in which challenges manifest themselves. But, and those are the principles against which one must assess what the FSC says. Now, in some years, in certain provinces, we have problems, some years more than others, some provinces more than others. Again, it's important to understand that point when one looks at the information supplied by the Treasury. We've also got that information which has been supplied, but we speak to the Treasury itself. And then integration between the block grant and costed norms. Honourable Member said that it wasn't raised before, we've raised it now. We've taken it from the FSC's statement, this thing, because they speak about a block grant, and the principle of what they're suggesting is that for this block grant to work, it must be informed by some assessment of need. And they then speak about the cost of norms. It's not us who's introduced it, it's there as the FSC's recommendation. We're simply responding to it. And in reading it, we're saying that it's important to read the second part of the sentence in addition to the first part. Because what the second part does is it says block grant. But how do we decide the size of that block grant? How do we decide the question of adequacy about whether it's going to meet needs? This is the debate that started 10 years ago. It's a debate which, in principle, we all agree with. What we've been debating since then is do we have an ability to make that calculation? And do we have an ability to mitigate perversion? And what I mean by that is, let's assume you do a cost of norm and you find that your budget has to increase 5 times. How do you manage that in the context of the other recommendation the FSC is making about managing the deficit? So it's about how do you reconcile those things, and that's where the cost of norms fits in. So to repeat, it's not our insertion into that recommendation. It comes directly from the FSC. And our reading of it is not put there lightly. It's part fundamentally of the recommendation, which is why we responded to it. The other issue is that, you know, we must raise the thing about assessment, cost effectiveness, about comparison between independent and public. We did not suggest that this is what the FSC said. What I was talking about is what we think the usefulness of cost effectiveness assessments are. And indeed, that is a usefulness. The cost effectiveness, in methodological terms, is context specific and it begs comparison. So you compare within the public sector, you compare within the independent school sector, and for us, our use it is to compare between public and independent. Whether we've done studies, yes, indeed we've done studies. We've applied the methodologies. We've done a review of the comparative advantage of independent schools versus public schools if you compare for socioeconomic status. We can make those studies available. We'll make the whole review available. But we're saying that in accepting the recommendation on board, Chair, we're saying we're illustrating its usefulness. And for us, this is an important usefulness in it. Because, you know, the reason why one does cost effectiveness is to say, how can you best use the resources available to you to achieve more? Embedded in that question fundamentally is how school A achieves X results with less resources than school B, or how school A achieves more results with the same resources, more results with more resources, etc. That is embedded in cost effectiveness. And in fact, by definition, you can't do a cost effectiveness study by using one program or one school. Cost effectiveness in methodological terms is a comparison. That is it. Otherwise, you're doing an efficiency study. So I don't want to get pedantic about that. I'm trying to explain what motivated our response to it. In terms of five, National School Nutrition Program, honorable member raised a question about infrastructure. Does it cover it? My colleague will speak in detail there, but you put your finger on a very important issue. What we do currently with school nutrition program, we sometimes go out and tender and people outside provide, which means they've got their own facilities. We're trying to move to a situation now to empower schools to create facilities where they can empower the community to be able to provide for the school nutrition within strict criteria of health and so forth. In that is criteria for infrastructure, and we support that as well. But my colleague will give details. And you're speaking about specific examples, it seems. If you can supply that to us, we'll also follow up there to deal with that issue. Honorable Chair, even the question you raised, you know, there's policy and there's specific examples. It's important for us to get a specific example because very often the policy is not implemented properly. If we know that, we can intervene directly and deal with that. In terms of dinner lady, honorable member, how long will it remain? Again, that's a key question to raise. We're asking that question repeatedly. We're saying we've got the 500 schools, there is success. We don't want to pull out and drop any schools out at this point in time. But essentially, we want to expand this thing. We want to expand capacity to deliver science and math to all schools in the country or to focus schools. And in that regard, we're reviewing constantly how we deal with that. But currently, there's no intention to drop any schools out of that dinner lady program. The next one is provinces not allowing sufficient funds, which provinces, you know, to what extent, etc. Again, the information will be supplied by Treasury. But the Honourable Member made an important point in raising that intervention. He spoke about unauthorized expenditure because of insufficient budget. Honourable Chair, that problem comes about in many ways. Some years it comes about because of maybe inadequate financial management. That's a reality. In other instances, like the last financial year, and we're anticipating this financial year, we're set with a larger than anticipated increase. If you look at the occupational-specific dispensation, which I think what the Honourable Member is raising here, the amount allocated in the budget to Education Department did not cover that. So we had to look from within our budget to fund it. Many provinces didn't succeed, and they had an overrun. In some instances, Treasury gave a portion, not all, and the province had to find. In some instances, province allocated, other instances didn't, and we set with the problem. Now, this year, Honourable Members, you know, when we get our budgets, the Treasury puts in an anticipated increase into your budget, and you then budget according to that. In terms of what the state has got on the table currently, it's already above what's doing in our budget. Now, if we do our own modeling already, assuming we're not getting any additional money, we are going to have huge overruns. So that's the point, the Honourable Member, in relation to what you're saying. So what will happen now once the settlement is finalized? We then have to talk to Treasury and look at how that is managed in the wider context of the fiscal framework, which is essentially if we go the route of saying, okay, we're going to give everyone, including education, all the money they need to meet the salary increase, that impacts immediately on the deficit. Now, the question is, how does one manage the deficit? How does one make choices, et cetera? All those things have to play itself out. And that is a complex process through which that decision is arrived at. But certainly, that is the reality that some provinces are faced with. Honourable Chair, I think I've covered all the questions. With your permission, can I ask my colleague, Mr. Pariachi, to respond to the infrastructure provisions in the school nutrition program? Thank you very much, Honourable Chair.
Thank you, Chair, with your permission. The school infrastructure budget itself doesn't make a special allocation to deal with the infrastructure for the nutrition program. When the program started out, there was a specific allocation to set up the kitchen and so forth. But what we do have is that certain provinces in their budget have made allocation for kitchens and other provisions because there are guidelines and health and safety regulations that need to be complied with. I think if we could get the specific details of the schools that are affected, we can intervene and see to it that the provinces do address this issue. There's an invitation forward the specifics to Mr. Andrew, and he will get it to the department. Thank you for your presentation and the way you responded to the questions. We believe that the department will come to a solution regarding the wage issues. That's now a huge issue outside because it's affecting every one of us. If you've got children at school, if your wife is a teacher, what, etc. So we think of you. Treasury, thank you for the documents, Mr. Sano, that you submitted this morning after the request was given yesterday afternoon. Honourable members, did you receive this? It was handed out. You may make your input on the Department of Education, then Mr. Kumalo will follow with these remarks.
Thank you very much. If I can just limit myself to making four comments, four issues. The first one has got to do with how the provincial equitable share functions, and it to some extent also supports the data that's been provided. The equitable share consists of six components, and annually we actually provide the information as well through Annexure W1 that's accompanied by the Division of Revenue Bill. And education gets a 51% share, but that is just one component within the equitable share. There's other components as well, that, and particularly the issue with regard to poverty. There is in the equitable share also a component for poverty that's currently weighted at 3%, which indirectly speaks to all the other components as well. For example, if you look at the education components, that health component also addresses or speaks to the education component. So the poverty component also speaks to the health component. So when you actually look in the formula, yes, you can look at it in isolation, but you can also look at it from the 100% allocation and what that does. If you look at the actual allocations, you can see that with regard to both health as well as education, health gets 26% and education gets 51%. And if you then look at it and compare it against actual expenditure, which is actually then reflected in both tables 1 and table 2, it indicates generally most provinces actually spend the equitable share portion of that allocation and indeed more. And then the question comes, if they spend more, where do they get the money from? And where they get the money from is from the other components within the provincial equitable share formula, all out of own resources, where provinces collect, say, on average 3%, but in certain provinces it's higher where there's more economic activity, where it can go up to 8%, for example. So that's where they get the additional resources. Also, what needs to be looked at is, and that flexibility then enables provinces as well to address their own specific provincial needs. For example, if you look at the education component in KwaZulu-Natal, in 2019, they spent 91% on the education component. But if you go to the health component and you look at KwaZulu-Natal, when you compare to health, they spent 118%. So to some extent, it does indicate that provinces do, in both cases, prioritize the social services, and that quite a lot of resources are directed towards that. And the issue that needs to be dealt with is then the funds that they direct. Is it going, or are it going to the right spending items, and are you achieving the correct mix? And if you actually analyze the budgets in substantial or more detail, what you often get is that certain costs are, for example, if a province struggles with an education department in a province struggles with resources, for example, they would use the one to off-play the other one. To give an example, if they overspend on personnel, what they will do, they will scale down on other essential expenditure, which is not a good development. For example, you would see that in cases of essential support material the teachers need to use to actually do the training, they would underspend on that type of support. They will scale down on infrastructure in schools, which is also not a good development. But if you look at overall spending, it's there. Even within personnel, it's quite complex, and the challenges faced by individual provinces are very different as well, where you would get situations where, in certain cases, the overspending would be driven by OSD, for example. In other cases, it will be driven by people appointing people that's not on their organograms. In other cases, it would be a case where they overinvest in administrative staff and underinvest in core staff or teachers, for example. So it's quite complex, and every province needs a unique response to deal with that. Then a second issue that's related to that, how do you actually develop a good formula? Both for the provincial equitable share as well as the local government equitable share. And if you look at international literature, there's a number of criteria that's put down to form a good formula. One is that it should be fair or equitable. The second one, it should be predictable, i.e. province or municipality should know what they can budget for, and that's why we've got three-year allocations. We should have reliable information that's justifiable, and that information, and then also it should be simple and easy to administer. So you need to get the right balance between those factors as well. The moment you start moving towards a very detailed and lengthy formula, what you actually start getting is lack of reliable information. Some of the information is then not justifiable or accountable. To give an example, what we currently do is look at the Division of Revenue Bill. We release as part of Annexure W1 all the criteria that's used in the provincial equitable share formula. So each and every province can actually look at the information. We're actually credible, give the source as well, which is actually an important consideration. So if you start using 1,000 data sources, then the allocations get much less difficult and much less transparent, which can also become quite problematic. Then with regard to the scaling down or tightening the belts, and the Department of Basic Education did address it. When we mean tightening the belt, we don't mean tightening the belt on programs which makes a real difference. Tightening the belt means cutting down on bells and whistles and scaling down on non-essential expenditure. If you look at the National School Nutrition Program, $3.6 billion has been allocated this year. It increases to $4.6 billion. The next financial year, it increases to $4.9 billion the following year. Then also in addition to that, we do make money available to the Department of Basic Administration, Basic Education, for administering the grants as well. For example, 2010, they get 16 million rand for actually oversight of the program. And that's also an important factor to note. And then the last item that I just would like to address is how do we deal with the increased ICS with regard to the negotiations that's currently taking place. If it is higher than what was originally budgeted for, it becomes an adjustment budget issue. And of course, then a link to that available resources that's in the kitty. And just to also explain last year's process as well, both with respect to national government as well as provinces, the full amount was not given for a very specific reason, and that reason was that it was then to also create the scope for both provinces and national government to actually get savings from elsewhere, where expenditures taking place on non-essential programs and where wastage is taking place. So it was never intended to say you must under budget for it. It was actually a specific draft to ensure the efficiencies are achieved within government, keeping in mind that currently we've got allocations and all departments, national and provincial, must go back to their baselines or their overall allocation that they get available and relook at how the overall allocation is spent, because that is where the majority of the funds are actually received. And that is the area that we're currently targeting to get efficiency gains. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Let me also thank the Department of Education for Basic Education for a presentation that is very clear and very straightforward. I think from what they've presented here, we basically can start even thinking about some of the issues that we need to think about as we move forward that constitute challenges to the department. I don't want to engage too much in the numbers that have been presented by the National Treasury with respect to these comparisons between health and education and what provinces spend and what the formula allocates, because then it begins to bring in a certain dynamic. Why would you have such variations over a period of time? We really must think about the origins of those weightings and this component. And if one tells me that they are not indicative, then I have a problem with that, because my understanding of the origins is that they were based on past expenditure patterns on those particular components, and that is where they originate, and that they have been adjusted accordingly. So we really don't want to play around with words. I mean, we have used in the past words like arbitrary and all of that, but the point still remains that they mean something in terms of what we expect to see happening. We might not want to be very direct about it, but it's there. Let's not have that discussion now. The discussion that is on the table at this point in time is that there are options that have been presented by the Commission around the review of the equitable share formula, and the Commission presented those in 2009 as options. And in this current submission, the Commission decided to take its own position, because the agreement was that for 2011 we would have a new formula, and the Commission's position is that we need to move towards the block grants. That's the point. So to respond to Honourable Harris, the link between the costed norms approach and the block grants comes in the sense that if you have to then start calculating that, you need to be basing it on specific expectations of what you expect the provinces. So you can actually have norms that are on the input side. You can also have norms that are on the output side. So you have expenditure norms, which is, you can link it with what we currently have. I'm saying that the current weightings are based on past expenditure trends. And in terms of the simulations that we have conducted, we've actually looked at that, what has been spent. And you can actually use expenditure norms to do that, but it's not the best way to do it, because it does not actually tell you what the inefficiencies are in the system in terms of what those spending patterns demonstrate. So you can actually do that. We've done simulations around on the basis of those. And if one goes back to the technical report accompanying the recommendations that you tabled last year as options, you would basically pick up the patterns and what it actually does to the shares going to the different provinces and also the aggregate shares for health and education. You can actually get to those numbers. So basically there is a link, and I must agree with you that whilst the issue around the costed norms approach has been on the table for a long time, Treasury very reluctant to use it as an allocation as a means to determine allocation. They have not discarded it as a tool for analyzing whether you are actually going on the right direction. So that where there are norms and standards, where norms and standards exist, you can actually use that to actually assess the efficiency of those allocations. Now, the issue that is still outstanding is that in quite a number of areas, those norms and standards are still not there, which is probably why the issue around, for example, ECT, what happens to ECT if you put all of this thing into a block? What happens to ECT to protect it? Because the issue of fungibility of money does not disappear with the grant. You only lessen it in the sense that now it's fungible within this education block, but it's no longer fungible across the total pool of the equitable share, which is the current scenario. What Wendy has indicated is that if you are going to spend more on education and health, it means that you've taken from someone. But that is not the ideal situation that you want. You actually want to be as close to what you had as an objective as possible. Now, the problem that we have is that the equitable share currently is a tool or an instrument that is used to serve a lot of objectives. So you've got your developmental objectives. Provinces have these ideas around what the role of their role in development is and what their role in the other areas of concurrency is. And so you have all of these choices that you have to make, and that flexibility coupled with the fungible money that comes in the pool can actually create those types of problems, and which is the reason why the Commission is basically of the view that we probably need to try and reduce that degree of fungibility of resources so that we protect some of those key social spending areas that we think are vulnerable. We can talk about this 118% spending above the, but we know basically that OSD has presented so much pressure. If you look at our submission for the division of revenue for 2010 on the division of revenue bill, one of the key areas that we highlight as a potential challenge for provinces and their budgets is the OSD, basically. And already, what we are now faced with the strikes and all of that and potential increases, and it's more pressure on the personnel budget. And when we talk about the quality of education and the quality of healthcare, something will have to give someone, and those are the issues that actually are of concern in this respect. So let me leave it at that. I think with respect to, ECD and school nutrition programs and whatever happens with the review of the formula, because this discussion is still on the table. I think there are teams, the Treasury also discussing with people from education and also from health around these issues. But I think one of the important aspects of that is that once decisions are taken, some of these programs that are funded under conditional grant need not necessarily be affected, because it's really a question of the national department having fully satisfied itself that these programs have been fully institutionalized and integrated into the provincial budget process. So that should not application for those. It's really about the equitable share at this point in time rather than the conditional grants and how this then translates into that. I think that's an important point to remember. I think I want to agree with the Department of Education as well that the reviews that we are talking about in terms of expenditure effectiveness and the quality, it's really an important issue, and that is why we think that it's important that these are actually carried out by an independent body. Now, the choice, obviously, what the DG is raising is that you create a market once you do that, and that is a fact, that you will create a market. So it means the choice of the institution that you entrust with this particular exercise is a key a decision point that has to be made. I don't think that from where we sit, we basically thought about it and we say to ourselves that as a commission that there is now a department that is tasked with monitoring and evaluation, and that department can actually drive that process and probably would come up with a credible institution to address those kinds of issues. I think the other thing that I wanted to comment on is the issue around the learner transport. Just to remind the House that in 2007, the Commission did a table submission on the matter of learner transport, and one of the recommendations there was the need for high level discussion between the Department of then Department of Education and the Department of Transport in terms of sorting out that issue. I am not very. I know that those recommendations were accepted, and I'm not sure what the process is. But from what the DG is saying, it seems to me that process is still ongoing, and so there is a need basically to try and check what is happening there, because I think what we had found at that particular point was a serious problem that learners, especially in rural schools, were actually faced with, and also even in urban areas. I mean, the kind of transport and the safety issues and all of that was quite an issue, but in different provinces, you would find that a different department is responsible for it, and so you can't actually make sense of what is actually happening, what are the norms, and all of that. So, but let me stop.
Thank you, Mr. Kumalo. Thank you, Honorable Harris. Follow up.
Just a very quick one, Chair. The I appreciate Mr. Kumalo's point, which I think is that he's disputing the fact that the 51% is something we should even be treating as an appropriate benchmark. That's fine. I can accept that we shouldn't be debating that now. But I just want to remind everybody that the point of provinces is that they are closer to the people and they're better able to tailor these budgets to the situation on the ground. And in some cases, it does actually work. Just look, given that the departments, many of them, including the one last night and now Basic Education, have come here and have assessed the block grant proposal, I think, in terms of the actual 51% weighting. They're saying that there's been an implicit assumption that some provinces aren't spending in line with that 51%. The figures from Treasury and the Basic Education Department actually asked us to assess it based on a multi-year rather than a single year. So I hope my calculation's right. I just plugged the numbers in here. And it turns out that over the last 4 years, 8 of the 9 provinces have spent higher weighting than 51% on basic education. The one province is KZN, which spent 8% less. In total, on average, over 4 years, over the 9 provinces, they spent 7% more So I don't think there's, if you accept the 51% weighting, I don't think there's a clear case to be made that the provinces are not spending what they're given for education sufficiently. And that, to me, accepting the 51%, perhaps raises serious questions over the justification for a block grant.
Honourable Makubela.
Thanks, Chairperson. This one, the DGIST is not going to answer, but to investigate and see. There is a science center in Giani. You see, it was everything, but gradually, that science center has been left out. It's fading away. Teachers have been removed. Just to investigate and see, right, won't that science center be one of the extension in order to assist this mobile science laboratory? Just to investigate, it seems as if it's not utilized optimally.
Thank you. We thank Mr. Padiachi for the presentation, for you and your team that came here. Pardon? Sorry.
I just thought one would say you fired me and replaced me.
No, I don't fire people. We are going to a provincial week from the 6th until the 10th of September. Then there's a constituency period from the 20th of September into October. Now, listen to education and dealing with education matters. When we visit our schools, we will have to look at, did the schools really order their learner support material for next year? They're supposed to have ordered it in July. School budgets, are that being drawn up? Is a meeting set for that SGB to deal with a specific school budget? And then the readiness of that school for the end of the year exams. Seeing what we are going through now, these past 10 days, and what is lying ahead until next week with the union, that will be part of our work when we go back to constituency.
We want to appreciate for being granted an opportunity to come and present and share with the committee our views in terms of the FFC proposal. On the chapter 3 issues, we're going to cover the towards an effective, efficient, and transparent intergovernmental fiscal system. On those four areas, improvement of performance and effectiveness of fiscal transfers, the local government revenue improvement strategies, reforming local government civil share, and regionalization of municipal services. Whilst on chapter 4, we're going to be giving input on the intergovernmental fiscal issues in urban transport. Let me quickly jump to the issue of the FSC, because we all know that their role is to provide research into local government fiscal matters as on other aspects, focusing on providing practical solutions to current challenges in the fiscal system and how exactly the equitable share formula must be reconstructed to derive more equitable allocations. There is currently no monitoring checksum of how government has implemented past recommendation of the FFC. While new ones are proposed, we know that FFC has been proposing a number of issues.
I can just, and you must correct me if I'm wrong, when the Minister of Finance tabled the budget, we were issued with the documentation, the maroon books, and at the back there was the remarks from Treasury regarding, if I recall correctly, on the FFC's recommendations. My colleagues must assist me now. I'm trying to think aloud. But that's from Treasury as a department. Wendy will deal with that. Carry on.
Okay, thank you very much. Improvement the effectiveness, I'll explain that when we go thoroughly on my presentation. What areas of focus we mentioned. Improvements on effectiveness of fiscal transfer, the FFC recommendation on the introduction of the termination of conditional grants are highly supported. On an independent evaluation of grant performance, yes, we really supporting that. We as well emphasizing on the issue that these business plans must be analyzed before implementation of the new grant. E.g., there should be a clear guideline that must be developed for factoring the design and planning of a grant into business plans. For instance, the FSC was saying there's a need for a tailor-made a grant on the issue that relates to the province to address certain challenges. We're saying if that is the issue, the grant, is it supposed to be a risk grant? Maybe we must propose that it should be a risk grant. We don't know, because it's a tailor-made. It's for a certain time to mitigate a certain challenge. As far as we're saying, we can welcome it if it will be clearly designed to be a risk grant. But however, there should be more emphasis on non-financial data reporting. The test, we have to test the readiness of municipal administrative system before implementing the grant, because of the, if you see what the turnaround strategy says, it has identified the number of gaps from our municipal systems. The fiscal support should take a holistic view to ensure that various grants operate as a system to develop municipalities. We currently have more than 15 grants that are not consolidated, and that municipalities are supposed to ensure an effectiveness in way of reporting to the line department on a number of different time frames or equal a certain time frame. So you have to report to COCTA, you have to report to National Treasury, you have to report to wherever the grant is coming from. So our plea would be saying maybe we have to move towards consolidating this grant. I don't know what the FSC and I know that they've been agreeing with us on this matter. Government must consider integrating all this grant because it takes more time for us to manage and monitor the compliance on addressing this grant as local government than providing actual services. On the incentivizing of innovation, we highly supporting it. But however, what the municipalities with limited or no capacity needs to be capacitated prior to or in conjunction with the incentive based grant. The second thing that we are raising is not the chain. I was quickly raising and scratching my head to say it's a very good move and proposal. But we then have to see how do we legally make sure that it's covered. Because once you have budgeted, whatever you spend should be in line with the budget. And we encourage the municipalities to advance a revenue cashback budget. So that when we address and manage the incentives, there should be an allocation somewhere in the budget to say this is how we're going to manage it so that it's legal as well. And we can comply on how we report on that. The incentive must be set at a level that actually encourages innovation. And we agree with what the FSC says. SALGA is of the view that, however, that is the current grant framework do contain indicators and measures such as the outputs to be achieved. However, there is no reporting on this non-financial measure that we sometimes find. Municipalities report to land department, I've already mentioned that. Maybe I should skip that. But the emphasis here is that we want that there should be clear coordination and consolidation of the non-financial performance reporting at the national level. We do know that the National Treasury monitors and reports on spending against the budget. on a number of times. When coming to the local government revenue improvement strategy and fiscally distressed municipalities, FFC recommends on the improvement of the general performance in municipal revenue collection. We're highly supporting it at SALGA. There's establishing early warning system of financial distress, setting standard indicators to harmonize revenue collection, balancing debt collection, and so forth and so forth. What we as well were emphasizing here, I know that it's not a matter of a month, but if you read the document presented by FSC before recommendations, there is a clear explanation and maybe analysis of the local government turnaround strategy, where it simply says, however, even if municipalities go to the far end to try to do a more robust revenue enhancement strategy or advance it, there is well the other hand, which is communities that are trying their level best in terms of formulating the number of groups like taxpayers and so forth. So we're simply saying, because we know that there is going to be a differentiated approach that the FSC is proposing, the how part of us ensuring that this financial distress will be assessed, even that all of us are agreeing on a differentiated approach, we will be very happy to can hear how FSC can help us on that. But the simple thing is that, first of all, FSC, we can maybe do a study. We know that most of the municipalities are not in a position to make any loan anyway because of the financial distress. Is it possible to work out a document that will say, in the indicative figures, the dollar allocations, can they be reinforced and municipalities take a loan against them? But they should be reinforced and monitored if national treasury will agree. So that municipalities with financial distress can quickly implement some serious delivery challenges at this earliest moment. The recommendation on the issue of garnishes and orders on defaulters customers is strongly supported. FSC to share full results on details of the study of municipal fiscal capacity and fiscal efforts. They normally come to a working group, so we're just inviting you that in the next working group, let us have that report. The national and provincial treasuries must monitor municipal revenue improvement plans, including SALGA. Guidelines must be provided for the development of municipal revenue improvement plans. Municipal financial system should be audited to address challenges around billing systems. There are around 14 different financial systems. For example, in Free State, that are currently being utilized. We need to go together with COPT and say how effective does these systems assist municipalities being used across all municipalities in the province. So we just take an example of Free State province. Ensure accuracy of development of customers and property database. Revenue management plan should be accompanied by national and provincial government support, especially so smaller and more rural municipalities. Reforming local government, which will share for you. SAGA agrees with the recommendation that improving the institutional support allocation to smaller municipalities will sustain their administrative and governance operations. FSC to provide solutions share solutions together with SAGA on how this can be achieved in the formula. Because we know that for the past 10 years, we've been seeing that issues that relate to maintenance should be put in the migrant. And we know that's what we say in the reform monitoring, because that has not yet been put in the basic service grant. SAGA's own analysis indicates that there are around 40 municipalities that cannot fund salaries and wages. With the combination of institutional support grant component and the special support for councillor remuneration, no indication of analysis of the arbitrary 350,000 base amount in the institutional support component. The recommendation on the RRC is supported, but the broader principle of the differentiation between municipalities within the formula is not yet addressed. Maybe we need to move towards addressing that one. FSC must provide practical solutions on how to replace the current RSC. Reforming the review of the formula together with the review of local government fiscal framework that is currently underway should focus in the short term on allocating additional funding to the institutional support component for formula to increase the allocation to smaller municipalities who are primarily reliant on grant. Like you go to a municipality, as seen in the document, this comparison of Saldanha Bay and Mushawe, I cannot compare the two. The two are totally different. Mushawe is, you know, the same Mushawe will always be at the lower and Saldanha Bay will be at the top. But we're simply saying those are the areas that we see they rely on the grants, like Moretele municipality. Over the medium-term review should focus on expanding the basket of basic public services that municipalities provide, reviewing the poverty line. Currently, the 800-month income per household is not same for practice same in municipalities, including in provincial and national government. The housing poverty line, it's 3,005, while others are saying it's two pensioners income, and the others are still saying it's 800. So we really need to have to come up with a review in the poverty line. Salga is concerned, however, that the FSC's recommendation over the last few years have not been followed. E.g., the 2006 recommendation of the development component on and the 2010 recommendation of including road maintenance as part of the formula is not yet been addressed. That was the basis that was saying the monitor, not to say national preservation document, but was saying a number of proposals presented by the FSCs are not yet being implemented. When speaking about regionalization of municipal services in terms of the EDI, the EDI Holdings and the Department of Electricity, of Energy, is best placed to take up the debate about the merits and the demerits of the regionalization. Because currently there is a cabinet decision. We're thinking that if we want to start reviewing that particular decision, it should start from, we need to engage the relevant department to say this is the position where we think we have to review so that we go en route to the possible committees of parliament and then and to parliament. But as Salga, we supported it precisely. There was already a cabinet decision on the matter. We're not saying it should not kick started the new debates, but we're saying the land function that has presented it for a cabinet decision should as well look into that. The FSC report should provide the quantitative financial and fiscal implications of the arguments around the rates. Saga comments electricity is a key contributor to municipal revenue. A significant portion of the EDI income accrues to the national entity ESCOM, from which local government draws no financial benefits. Local government does not receive income from key industrial customers, which is still a challenge, like the mining industry, and this has an impact on the municipal financial viability. You'll find that a municipality is a license holder. There is no ESCOM around. But the municipality, the mines are not going to buy electricity via the municipality. So those are some critical challenges. The bulk electricity is normally done through ESCOM. On general recommendations, Chairperson. Okay. Recommendation one is supported a blanket regionalization approach as per the 17th Amendment of the Constitution. But as further, we've got our position that we presented there. What is it that we're not supporting on that blanket regionalization? I don't have to open it because we raised our issues clearly to say, as far as we're not agreeing that the issue of water should be part, because as well, and the other issues that were raised, because otherwise the municipality would not have any other area to raise revenue. So we're still maintaining our position. Recommendation two, that the proposed differentiated approach of the SSC should be recognized. It should recognize the poor economic needs of some poor performing distributors that cannot be left on their own. What we're simply saying, we're saying that we should not group municipalities that have got high capacity only and regroup those without capacity. Either we have to make a mix so that there should be cross-subsidization on the matter. But if we're going to still say we're taking Red 1, for instance, as the Cape Metro, and not put it with other poor or incapacitated municipalities, and say, for instance, Mushaweng and Taung should be grouped under one, it does not make sense. We're saying at least there should be a mixed net. Like, for instance, Johannesburg can cut across until to where and accommodate other rural municipalities so that they can be cross-subsidization on this particular area. On the recommendation, should the EDI restructuring and establishment of rates go ahead? Recommendation one, the interdependence between electricity supply industry and EDI is not convincingly agreed in the report. That recommendation two, it may be prudent to review the appropriateness of the proposed solution to the EDI restructuring, but may prolong the uncertainty that is there in municipalities. Currently, there's been a long overdue uncertainty in the municipalities whether we really are going to lose revenue because we thought it's going to be a municipal entity, so forth and so forth. On recommendations, on recommendations to the EDI restructuring and establishment of risk go ahead. Recommendation 3, SALDA proposes that the process of for negotiating the deal issue be urgently finalized before the EDI restructuring bill. Recommendation 4, adequate compensation. SALDA supports this recommendation. Recommendation 5, compatibility of operating system is highly supported, but is seen as a responsibility of EDI holding. Recommendation 6, social objectives of making access universal. First part of recommendation is supported. On the second part of the recommendation, SALDA believes that the planning and directing the implementation of electrification program is a ministerial function. It can be done somewhere. It's in the IDP of the municipality, so we know electricity is needed. Recommendations are supported. I'm now on fiscal issues in the urban transport. Recommendations are supported as it will address the public transport challenges in major cities, not directed at local government. There is a need to monitor the rollout of the new transport initiative committee based on mainstream services such as the BRT. The initiative should not only be measured against passengers counts, like it's currently happening, and additional vehicle kilometers, but also against social welfare criteria. So we're simply saying a performance criteria of public transport service should be inclusive of the following: quality of access, different income and social groups, access to key activities and public service within a reasonable traveling time, passenger satisfaction with public transport service level routing, operating condition, waiting period, fear and crime, contribution to take up employment, healthcare, education, level of community participation, decision making, degree of integration with housing developments, and key public service. person or to thank you. I wish you welcome.
Thank you, DeSalva. Anything to add from your side? Nothing. All the members' questions? Here they come. We did oversight in 3 provinces. I'm waiting for his hands to go up on the machine. All the knees. Welcome, all the knees. Section 154 of the Constitution is a very important section. When we visited the provinces starting last year, that was the first question we asked. What support do national and provincial governments give local municipalities to perform in terms of their legislative mandate? Because it's quick to run to section 139. That must actually start at section 154. The other thing that came up, and Mr. Kumalo went with us to the Northwest and the Eastern Cape provinces when we listed those municipalities, is the investments that local municipalities have. But in their presentation on the third last page, when it comes to challenges, finances is listed. Like in Clarksdorp, 106 million rand in investments, but the challenge is finances, and they're complaining about the indigenous people. And we say, but they are suffering, and you have got investments. How does this tally up? Doesn't make sense. Also in the Eastern Cape. And that's things that we have to look at when we deal with this sphere of government. In our oversight, not to fight with them, but I think to give some direction. And maybe from Treasury side in their reports, their request from municipalities, ask that question. I liaise with the Minister of Finance, telling me, yes, they call it the fact. There's some fat in municipalities lying there that can be utilized maybe in a better way. You can start with your questions on the Makubela, on the Mashile, and on the Lees.
Thanks, Chairperson. What I can comment is what a wonderful report with a lot of suggestions, a very good one. But my problem is that the SALGA as part and parcel of us. It seems as if I'm answering myself with questions, and therefore I'm not going to answer them until they fill up the space in the NCOP of their seat there. Thanks.
I'm sure maybe it's because I'm sitting next to Makubela and my questions have done something to his head, or probably has got a trick of stealing on my thinking. Chair, I think because I think we got a report really from the chair. I think she's the chairperson of the finances or whatever in Salva. And I think they should have had opportune time of actually interacting even with the FFC if they are sitting in the NCOP with us.
Yeah.
And now they're coming in here as an interested party, whereas they were supposed to be part of us.
Yeah.
I think, Chairperson, we just have a small predicament when it comes to that, and possibly maybe we can get an explanation. Why are they not taking their seats in the NCOP? So that some of the questions that they are raising here, I think it should have been dealt long ago, before we actually meet with the rest of the department. And the other thing, Chair, to raise is that you see, in my opinion, SALGA functions like a union of municipalities. In my opinion, it may not be 100% on the ground like that. Therefore, one would be expecting that SALGA as well, on its own initiative, can instill some of the good practices that they think will assist the municipality. Because I'm raising that because there are questions here which say FFC must come up with a solution. And instead of them, you know, it's making some research and presenting certain proposals to FFCs, you know, trying to influence FFCs recommendations to government. Because the first one which I was just worried is they questioning the 350,000. What is there that they want for the municipality? And how have they tried to influence whoever is taking this decision, you know, on the appropriate amount? That is what one is expecting. And Chair, the other issue, I'm worried. Yesterday, I think we have been talking about this intention of wanting ultimate powers of withholding funds and all that. Now, SALGA is coming up with a garnishing order. They say they are supporting that wholeheartedly. But on one side, they agree that their systems in the municipality is not 100% correct. Some municipalities are guessing bills and they are estimating bills and all sorts of things. And now, when you talk about garnishing orders, I mean, it's what will inform this particular decision? Are we not going to see people being penalized for things that are not only the municipality? They go to court, the municipality pays a lot of money again in court fees, you know, when they have actually made mistakes. And then we find some of these fruitless expenditures rising up and up and up in municipalities. And I would have been happy if they are really seriously embarking on a project to ensure that municipal systems in terms of generating bills and the management of that get more cleaned up so that then the rest will just fall, Chair. And I think those are the issues that I just wanted to raise, Chair. But a serious explanation why her division in SALGA cannot finance SALGA people to take their seats in the DOB. If one can just get that explanation, because it looks like it's a rest in their court. Thanks.
The Honourable Mashiva is actually referring to Section 67 on page 40 of the Constitution regarding the role of SALGA in the National Council of Provinces. Your 10 seats are still waiting. Since we were deployed here last year, occasionally there's someone coming to participate in a debate and then leaves before the debate is finished. I'm checking on it. Because that SALGA must utilize, in terms of the Constitution, the space that is created to participate. When we visit provinces, SALGA is part of it, to make their input to solve the issues and problems we experience during our oversight for that week. What can we deal with immediately, and what will take longer? That's the role of this committee. I want to believe.
Chairman, through you to SALGA. I did battle a little bit with the presentation, so forgive me if I haven't fully understood. But I would like to know what is meant by the integration of grants. Does that mean that you want municipalities to get a single grant, which is not conditional? Or does it mean that the reporting on the spending of the grants should be consolidated to one point? They're very different things, and it's really not clear to me. And if it's a kind of unconditional single grant you're looking for, then I think that may be a factor. Mr. Chairman, one of the major things that I have seen in my travels with you to various areas of the country and interviewing municipalities, is indeed the lack of capacity. Now, Zelda seems to think that these municipalities should be capacitated. All that means is that we have to spend more money to do so in an area which is unsustainable. Why is Zelda not looking at consolidating municipalities, reducing the number of municipalities? Why do we need to have these little unsustainable municipalities that we now have to capacitate with more of taxpayers' money? Why do we need to have chief financial officers for a tiny little municipality in the middle of nowhere when that same officer can look after a much bigger area? Can we have some kind of justification? Why is Zelga not indeed looking the other way and saying, this is unworkable, this municipality is unsustainable, how can we consolidate it with other municipalities, rather than throwing more money at it? Because that's what capacitation means. What is meant by consolidating non-financial performance reporting? If it means reporting on project progress and completion, is there an implication that where the funds have been spent, they may not have been spent on what they were meant for? That's the sense I'm getting here. Are we saying we report we've spent the money, but no one's asking us how we've spent the money? So is Zelga saying to us that we need to be concerned about this, that conditional grants are in fact being spent for purposes that they are not intended? You know, the problem with outstanding debts in municipalities is alarmingly huge. And I think it's a universal problem throughout the country, whether you're looking at a so-called highly capacitated municipality or not. And it's not the billing system that's the problem. The problem is a culture of non-payment. That's the problem. If you look at one specific municipality, Mnambithi, Ladysmith, from where I come, even the councillors were 90 and 120 days in arrears a month or so ago. And I had to raise it, and the provincial treasury is now looking at it. So the billing system is a side issue. Many billing systems, and probably the majority of them, are actually working quite well. But it's the culture of non-payment, this entitlement, even at public representative level, which is the problem. And that's a political problem. That's not an admin problem. Mr. Chairman, comment on the implementation of REDS. You know, the function of local government is to provide services, not to make a profit. Now, part of providing services is to provide them at the lowest possible cost. And therefore, the economies of scale have to come into play here. And REDS are economies of scale. And if it provides services at a lower cost, then that is the way we should be going. And I don't think that one can justify maintaining the supply of services such as electricity and water at local government level on the basis that we need the money from it. They're services that we must supply at the lowest possible cost. That's our objective, not to make money out of it. I'm astounded that Zelga wish to expand the basket of basic public services that municipalities provide, given that their service delivery currently is so poor. Surely we should get it right, what we are trying to do, before we start expanding the basket. Chairman, I think that covers my notes as I went through. I'd be interested to hear the comments from Zelga. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just on the issue, two issues that I want to raise. I want to fully agree with you that the participation of SAGA and the NCOP is very much of a concern. And can I also just put on record that since 2004, when I was in the NCOP, they never used to attend either. And as you rightly said, they sit for 10 minutes and they leave before the end of the house. And one could count on one hand how many times have they really attended the sittings of the house. So I thought I'd just have to put that on the table. It's not since 2009, it's since 2004. And I don't know what happened before that, because the NCOP has been in existence since 96 or something like that. So one minute. But I must, the chairperson, allow me to comment on the previous honourable member's commentary. And it's quite scary that some of the people are still not in touch with what is really happening in the communities. The assumptions that he was making here is really, really scary. And I think I suggest that they do go and see what's really happening in the communities and not come here and make assumptions like these.
What have to be looked at. We'll get to that.
Be specific, the honourable member's comments. It shows how out of touch is the opposition with what is happening out there.
Mr. Chairman, on a point of order, this committee does not operate like this, and I would beg you to control this person. We operate on a completely a non-emotional, non-accusative way. And that is the way this committee has worked since I've been here, and I appreciate the role you have played in making that the case.
Now, let us just calm down. The rugby test is only on Saturday afternoon, 5 o'clock. Different people will have different views about what they see. And it is, and that's what we're trying to emphasize, is our specific role, not only when we do oversight, but also in our constituencies where we are deployed, doesn't matter by which party. To go back, not only where it's going well, but to go back where people are suffering. And that is what is disturbing me. When you engage with municipalities, giving you files and files of documents, but people are sitting without drinking water, without electricity, without street lights, battling like Leopoldsfontein for 5 years to get electricity to a small town. It's in my constituency. And I interacted with the Minister of Energy. Why must they wait for 5 years? We must play our role. And if we come across anything that we have, the municipality, local government is not performing in terms of the government's program, then you act. Then it's your responsibility as a member of parliament or a councillor to take that department on, or that MEC, or that minister, or deputy minister, what the case may be. Then you're doing your job, because then you can go back to your people and say, you address your issue at a specific forum. I'm going to leave it there. But the other thing is, as we engage here with the FSC, with SALGA, when we visited provinces and municipalities, the same has happened at legislators. We can't stop here. That we invited chairpersons of the portfolio committees on finance. And the idea is that this role out in provinces within their oversight framework, referring to the program of the legislator. How often do a portfolio committee go out on oversight, like the Portfolio Committee on Finance. And I know in the Free State, especially Skopa, they are given 14 days and say, you read the province, go and do your work. But the chair of chairs phoned that chairperson, where are you now? What are you doing? I was there. They trained us 3-4 years ago from the Northern Cape. I come from the legislature in the Northern Cape. So the actual things must happen there. We can set the tone here, but it must have a snowball effect. You may respond, then it will be Treasury and then Mr. Kamal.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I really want to commend members of Parliament for presenting this question. Some of them are comments, some are really issues that need to clarify on them. But not bad. Let me avoid bad, Chair. And as we agree on the first question that was robustly raised, the participation of Salga. One critical issue that currently Salga has been looking into was Sage Copter. We know that we've got 10 seats at the NCOP. Most of councillors are full-time councillors and must focus on local government. Number of occasions we have to be in Parliament, in the committee. So we're saying that we really indeed need a legislative review. To see from the experiences and the practical situation that we found ourselves as representative body of local government, which of course one of our mandates is to lobby, advocate, to play advocacy lobby and represent. It's hampered by the issue that says we have proposed to have 10 members, which of course has been approved. But we're saying to the Minister of Cook that we want it to be full-time so that there can be a full-time representation in the NCOP for the interest of local government. So that we avoid this matter of saying there should be people staying there for 10 minutes. From there, they have to rush for the flight and run for another engagement of the municipality. So we're looking into those issues. We're saying we've realized it's a problem for us as founder, so that we make more impact as a representative body to our member municipalities. We have to really focus on participation on full-time basis, not on part-time basis. That is a challenge that we're facing as founder. We don't know because there's a team, there's a committee that deals with legislative review, which is currently led by the DM of local government. Probably they'll take it as part of a package for new things of doing things. But I think we had your views. We're going to take it back to the entire executive to say the NCOP select committee is not happy. Members who were sent there, they were leaving before time. And that is the first report that we're having. We didn't have that report. I didn't have that report before. That members sent us up. Because when we send people, we even tell them what time is the meeting going to end. Unless there is duplications of portfolio committees, where a member must sit in select committee of finance and rush to that particular select committee on one day to cover all the presentation. That's how strenuous sometimes is in Cape Town. What we said with the chairperson of NCOP, we said Salga, we would be very pleased to have the year planner of NCOP sittings, including the select committee sittings. In the beginning of the year, we discussed with MP Mahlangu, so that we can streamline our people and say, please, in your diaries at municipalities, book this day, the whole day, for NCOP or for National Assembly committees, so that we don't have an area where there is no representation. But I think it's an area that we have identified as well as Salga, and we appreciate members for raising it, but we're working on it. It's not a very a nice to say thing, but it's something that as well as Salga we've recognized. That's why we said maybe we have to make sure that our plans, we know in the early years of the year, so that we can plan better for more representation and for for full-time accurate representation in the NSOP meeting. Because our input makes a difference in what the NSOP is saying. And we know the passion and the commitment NSOP have for playing oversight for issues that affect local government. That's why we say our role there is highly critical.
This committee will assist you with that, to get hold of that program. We'll do it immediately.
Okay. Thank you very much. On the issue of FSC, it's quite evident. When I was present, I said some of the Jamsia help, but I was saying Salga and FSC. So that together, because they are sitting in our working group in Salga. So I was saying Salga and FSC. And we appreciate all the comments that for us not being there on time, things might leave us. Now coming to questions. The issue that relates to the best practice and innovations. Of course, we do have innovations and best practice that sometimes we even share with FSC some of our innovations. We really have them. On the issue of the 350, we're just simply saying there's a need to review that, precisely because it does not meet, it does not cover the basic institutional support. From what we've seen and the experiences in municipalities. The issue of the commission versus the billing system, we're agreeing that when we look to the municipal revenue enhancement strategies, categorically there will be areas where municipalities will be saying there's a need for a data cleansing. For those that they know that the billing is not accurate, because a number percentage of municipalities believe that the issue that relates to the billings might be a problem in other areas. We don't deny that. It's a fact. And then there's an area that relates to data cleansing. But we say for those that we know it's accurate, like for instance, there is no problem, I'm giving an example with one municipality. There is no problem in an industry or a business or an education department for not paying their rates. But we just simply say we cannot garnish a public sector. What we did as Salga was to request for the provincial and national treasuries to assist us in getting that particular rate. But we can maybe introduce a private, what we are preaching is to have a private business practice of revenue enhancement, a robust one. If it's a matter of saying municipalities must ensure that they establish what is called municipal financials, like when an Edgar's a chain store want to do, then you'll have a call saying, MP so-and-so, Edgar's financial. You are owing. When do you think you're going to pay? Others who are losing this file at the end of the next 24 hours. So people run and pay. Isn't it? So we're even saying to municipalities they can start using the same system. Maybe in getting 3, 4, 10 people, give them an office. Their way is only to targeted revenue a cost recovery measure. And to say to a person, if got an argument, a query, the person can come to say and say, my problem is a meter, I don't have a meter, or my meter is underground. So that is as well, somebody can focus on those particular areas. So that we see how best we can address the issue. But however, Chair, I want to say on the issues that relates to non-payment of culture, where there are areas where municipalities are faced with a number of taxpayers' associations. There is some way a breakthrough to other taxpayer associations where they are now granting those monies to the municipality. I'll give an example to a taxpayer association that was established in Madibe municipality, where the spokesperson was very high. After an engagement with COPTA, and SALGA on that matter. The taxpayers association is now part of the what is called the Municipal Consultative Stakeholders Forum. So what they've done as a pilot in that municipality is to say we need to engage robustly so that the issues that relate to the democracy of this country, like community participation, is a matter that says we're aware municipalities that have challenges in the functionalities of ward committees. So robustly going out there, we've established a model. It's a current model. It's a pilot. It's about 3 months now. It's a pilot where they say all stakeholders must come and they establish what is called a consultative stakeholders forum. So the taxpayers association that was there, they have now currently closed their bank account, the trust fund, and they've handed over the money to the municipality. And that is a very great breakthrough, because they've been engaged as a trust that can say if there's a problem of maintenance, what solution do they think they can assist municipality as a community, as a structure with the capacity, having engineers and special people expertise, how can they assist a particular municipality? A number of engineers are coming there voluntarily. So I can take three hours to just assist the municipality, maybe in addressing the issue of water or the issue of roads. So it's a pilot, we'll see and that consultative program is divided into four clusters. One of the clusters deals with service delivery, where community members are chairpersons, deputy chairpersons, secretaries, deputy chairpersons. They go, they do research, they call directorate, they call councillors, and together they plan and say, if this is the problem, what is the possible solution, and how do we resolve it? So the other one is finance. A cluster, the other one is community mobilization, the other one is economic and planning, which looks into the growth path and economic growth path of the municipality. It's a concept that these days is piloted by Cooperative SALGA in that municipality and working well. That municipality is currently under Section 139 and it's currently going well. So I was just addressing the issue of the building and the garnishing. Mayur is going to deal with the issue of that relates to the integration and the consolidation of the grants. We're just raising this because it's a nightmare for municipalities to do 15 reports at the same time, because you have to comply and provide monthly reports, quarterly reports of all these different grants to different line functions and departments. But Mayur will put more emphasis on it. The issue that relates to the lack of capacity in municipalities and SALGA to reduce municipalities. Municipalities currently member of parliament are defined by the demarcation boards, because the demarcation boards are the ones that will say this area can be a municipality or not. But we'll see what is it we can do. We of course say we're saying to what we've approached and agreed in a presentation and supported and recommended the differentiated model by COCTA. Currently, precisely we are aware that even on the issue of issuing grants, we have to then say, if I issue a grant on infrastructure, for instance, for water, when I say the municipality at Eastern Cape at and I just want to compare the two with Johannesburg Metro. When you say you give them a bulk infrastructure grant, the cost of the basic service of providing that is not going to be the same. But the grants from the National Treasury will be the same allocation. Why? Because a number of issues affect the definition and the definite timing of that particular total grant. The issue that relates to the geotechnical surveys are not going to be the same. You go to the Eastern Cape, the area might be in a rural area, should be far from one point to another, the area might be rocky, not a very nice soil condition. You come to Gauteng, the able to Johannesburg, the soil condition will be more accessible and cheaper. So that's why we've agreed to the differentiated approach. Because we're aware, even today, there is nobody, even FFC. Together with FFC, we've been raising the point to say, what is the basic cost of a service? Today, we don't have a response. We know, we've been raising it with FFC, that we need to define the basic cost of providing a service. The chairperson, I was trying to go to the other issues will be addressed by consolidating, okay, the culture of famous Arasa commands when we take in them. The issue that expanding the basket, I think Imayuru will address it. The participation since 2005 addressed it. We take in note, Chairperson, that you made mention that they are best presentation sometimes done with good documentation versus what is the practical nature of the scenario on the ground. Yes, we know that the SALGA, there is a tendency of doing that. Hence, we encourage members when we want to appreciate the members when oversight is done, we must go to the actual fiscal area. Because there's been a tendency, even as an employer body, we know that official has got a particular tendency to give out the best presentation. Sometimes they are doing this precisely because councillors are not playing enough oversight. Precisely because there still has to be a debate to say, how do we then advance an understanding or interpretation of what is accountability versus oversight? And whether oversight is a matter that will say, in a cycle of planning, to the last issue that relates to an output, is it accountability an individual thing or a collective thing, or is it oversight both a collective thing or an individual thing? Because in local government, there is a tendency to say everybody must account. But we have to start streamlining to say who must account, at what level, the issues of road classification. Because councillors sometimes, because of the frustration, they'll tend up doing things, especially because there is full-time councillors and part-time. So you don't know as a full-time and part-time councillor who must play oversight. You know, that is still a question. But we say with COPTA, we need to start developing a way to say, how do we then empower legislative arm of council to make a clear play a clear oversight role? Because the mayor must play oversight on administration, but the mayor as well must report to council. The mayor together with council take decisions. Then who plays oversight? So that element of oversight is then compromised. Chairperson, you raised a matter that relates to most of municipalities having invested a lot of money and having most of the policies and so forth and so forth. Whilst in the last presentation of their presentation, they raised issues of Chinese and so forth. We still have to look into the specific areas that the chairperson raised. But let me grant one municipal area in Northwest, the Maliveng. They really have investment. And all these investment policies they've inherited. These invested policies, they are ceded to certain policies as well. So what the treasurers of the then councils before 1994 were doing was to say they were playing around with figures. They can go and invest on land, this and this. They can as well make investments. And then when during 1995, when the new democratic government, 1994, when the new democratic government came in, what they did in 1993-92, they started to introduce what is called the zero coupon base issue, which is a long-term investment. And this long-term investment will then be seeded to smaller policies. To say at the maturity level, this investment is a backup of this particular long-term one. So you find it very dicey. You'll be very lucky if a municipality, when that policy is seeded or it's matured, is not linked to another policy for you to provide a better solution. If you tap in one of that policies after it has matured, once you tap it, you must have enough revenue to can finance the other long-term policy that is there. Sometimes the challenge in Adan, I was giving one, which is Madibeng, basically. Hence, there is nothing that the municipality can do rather than going to a financial recovery plan to advance how they can manage and address that particular long-term investment. So we, as SALGA, still have to look into the Slackdog model. We don't know whether the same model is the new model. But I know that the district municipalities, because it's a new concept, it's a new concept of the new government. Most of the district has made investment. We have to look into, say, with COPTA, how does this investment in the district area then have to as well capacitate local municipalities where there is a resource problem. And we're taking it as a challenge, Chair. We agree with the committee that there is a number of challenges to a number of municipalities. I think Mayur will add some of the issues. I thought I've addressed some of the critical points where we take them as issues that are valid. Mayur.
Noble Chair. Members, thank you very much. I think the Chair has covered a lot of the issues. I'm just going to amplify a couple of points. I think the first point around good practices and what SALGA has been doing, I mean, I think we do have an engagement that we have with municipalities on an annual basis in all provinces called the Budget Week. And in fact, specifically around the revenue management earlier this year, we took good practices from some of the bigger cities and we shared that with municipalities across the country. So, you know, there are some initiatives underway to try and share some of those best practices. In fact, the FFC report also talks to this point about larger municipalities supporting smaller municipalities. The point about the garnishee orders, Chair, all we were doing was amplifying the report again. We were saying that there is, you know, you need strict credit control measures to be put in place. And clearly a garnishee order can only be implemented if your credit control policy is in place and you follow the correct credit control procedures. And what we've also found, as SALGA, is that in some municipalities, those credit control policies are not in place or they're not appropriate. So when you do try and follow a credit control procedure, even though you might be correct in terms of taking someone to court, if your policy doesn't say that they have the correct sort of clauses in there, you would not be able to attach the assets of your debtor. So one of the things that we have been trying to do, and something that we're going to try and develop over the next year or so, is develop a model credit control policy that we can share with all members, so that we ensure that they don't get into this legal, you know, loophole that many municipalities do find themselves in. As far as I think the point about capacity, lack of capacity, I mean, there are definitely some political challenges, we agree with that, but there are systems problems. And in fact, the most evidence of the systems problems is if you go to the Department of Public Works, they will tell you that most municipalities are not able to split the bills as they have requested. You know, government payment of government rates and services have to be split by each municipality. They have to charge the Department of Public Works, and depending on what the property is, national or provincial public works, an annual payment for the property rates, and they have to charge the respective line departments, whether it's, you know, Department of Education or Department of Health, for the service charges. And in many cases, I mean, even those departments have indicated that they get a single consolidated bill because municipality systems cannot split the bill. So there are systems problems within municipalities, which we think which needs to be addressed. You'll also find many municipalities whose databases, and that's what the chair was saying earlier on, cleaning up the databases. You know, they've got addresses that are 10 years old. They've never cleaned up a database. And we think that if you want to deal with revenue, those are maybe two areas. And what we were doing is we're adding to the FFC's recommendations around this and trying to put more specific interventions that maybe we can put in place to improve revenue collection across the country. Around the consolidation, Chair, two things. I mean, one is last year we did, together with the FFC, also said we need to streamline some of the conditional grants. So that needs to happen. We're not saying integrate all of that. But there is a need to integrate and to streamline the reporting. I think the chair was mentioning just now that, I mean, municipalities have to, depending on how many grants you have, you might have to report on 7 or 8 different grants to. Last year we did the exercise. I mean, out of the 15 grants, municipalities were reporting to about 10 to 12 different different sector departments. And what we were again emphasizing on this one was that it would be useful if all the reporting that is done to sector departments can be consolidated at a national level, so we can all get a clear picture of what's the non-financial performance against the grant. Like you've indicated, I mean, you know, your quarterly reports in terms of the appropriations, you get quite detailed reports from Treasury around that, but I don't think there's sufficient emphasis, and again amplified by the FFC report, sufficient emphasis on non-financial reporting.
Salga come up with a pro forma proposal. That's how we think it can look. Then we assess
in terms of
intergovernmental relations. I'm just thinking that we go forward, not wait 6, 7, 8, 9 months before we get started again.
We can hear from Wendy, but we're quite happy to work with Treasury and maybe work on something around it. They might know what's happening to the reports that are going to the sector departments. Maybe all we need to do is just consolidate at a national level, maybe not a new reporting format. Chair, let me stop there. I think a lot of the other issues have been covered. Thank you.
Mrs. Swanu.
Thank you very much. Quite a lot of issues were raised, and I'm trying to just zone in some of the things that can actually stimulate further thinking as well. The first one is to do with the differentiated approach. Everyone agrees to a differentiated approach and the need for a differentiated approach. Most probably just to indicate what type of things need to be considered. Firstly, you get larger metropolitan municipalities that sit with very unique challenges that's very different compared to other municipalities. What we like to refer to is built environment pressures. So there's very specific reforms that need to be considered there to actually streamline and reform the system. Everyone agrees, again, that most probably municipalities or metros and larger secondary towns are best placed to actually deal with the challenges faced specifically in those type of areas to get integrated human settlement development. Because what you currently get, two role players there. The two major role players is, for example, provinces that's responsible for housing, and then Metro is responsible for the reticulation, rollout of services such as water, sanitation, electricity, and the like. But Metro cannot deliver those services if the houses are not delivered. So you actually get a mismatch and a misalignment between what's happening on the provincial level and what's happening on the municipal level or on metropolitan level. What has currently happened, and that's one of the reforms that have been introduced, is that from this financial year, provinces have to specifically indicate at the start of the financial year what money they're going to make available to metros to actually, with regard to the housing subsidies, that they're then going to transfer to metros, which is a great step to actually address some of the challenges in the system. That doesn't mean that's the end. It's most probably eventually we need to get to a situation where those funds actually go directly from national departments to the metro is concerned, but everything needs to be done in steps. In terms of one of the outcomes identified in terms of the outcomes-based approach, outcome 8, which deals with human settlements, the agreement is that priority will be given to credit metro. Work is on the go, and there's some movement there if it's at long last, which is quite a good development. Another issue that's also very critical for metro is two additional issues that need to be kept in mind. With regard to metros and large secondary towns, if you compare the 2001 census data with the 2007 community survey data, that's where the majority of inward migration is taking place, or additional people actually being added, and there's large inward migration. And a lot of those people that actually move in are poor. And that is putting a substantial additional burden on metropolitan budgets to actually deal with that, because in it, unlike other municipalities, they need to deal actually and respond to additional service delivery responsibilities at a much faster rate than any of the other municipalities concerned. And we need to actually factor that into their budgets as well. Another thing that metros need to do is actually be very responsive and actually be starting in the future to be drivers of economic development within their areas, because that is one of the best ways that actually we can have job creation and actually support the poor. So those are things that we need to actually, when we reform the fiscal system, actually need to keep those things in mind. Then if we go to the different, or the remainder of the group, the second group, which is easy to identify, is in the deep, deep rural areas, which has also got very different constraints. There's a very direct link or ability of a municipality to collect own revenues linked to the economic activity. We all know in rural areas, particularly deep rural areas, there's very little economic activity. So it's extremely difficult for those municipalities to collect their own revenues. And we need to get the fiscal system to respond to those challenges on the first hand, and secondly, get systems in place to even, although it's very small, to actually get them to even use those bit of revenues that they've got at their disposal, because they are, in certain cases, at least a little bit of economic activity. Because the fiscus cannot respond to an inability of a municipality to collect their own revenues. And a lot more work needs to be done there to understand the challenges. For example, some of the anecdotal evidence that we've been heard is that some municipalities say it costs them more to actually put in place a property valuation role than what they can actually collect out of property rates. So those type of realities need to be kept in mind. And then, of course, you get the municipalities that's got combinations of both, where they've got some economic development taking place within certain areas and others do not. What makes it complicated is that you get different types of municipalities and the institutional issue is always raised. Again, you need to look at what is an appropriate institutional capacity for a municipality. Because you do get municipalities, again, where we can actually provide most probably some of the figures, we do analyse the budget received, where some municipalities that medium-sized or even smaller actually pay more for the municipal manager than what a metro pays or large urban municipality. In certain cases, some municipalities have very little service delivery responsibility. For example, wards and sanitation is not located with them. But they've got a huge number of people employed or staff employed. And so you can't justify and just say because, we cannot, or our salary bill is so big, therefore the fiscus must jump in. If they're genuine in the case that they need those staff, they support service delivery, and they're reasonably paid, then those are the type of evidence we need to actually reform the system. So it's quite complex. So you do get cases where municipalities do have financial challenges, and most probably some reforms are required to the equitable share and the fiscal system to more practically assist them, and what we need to support that is actual data and actually being able to differentiate between those two groupings. Then with regard to some of the issues raised, with regard to the, why has the development component not been introduced? That issue has been discussed quite extensively, and originally when the D component or the development component in the equitable share was seen as a potential issue that could actually be incorporated in the formula, four proposals were put on the table of what the development component can actually look like. The first one was to death of poverty. If a death of poverty component is introduced, it will most probably benefit the smaller rural municipalities. That was the one option. Another option was then that the D component look at the extent of backlogs. The MIC formula and all the infrastructure conditional grants currently do address that issue. Then the second or third one that was proposed was the employment creation one. We already got expanded public works grants that actually focus on that. And then another proposal was that the D component focus on economic infrastructure. If it takes that type of line, then who will benefit is the exact opposite of the first proposal, which would mean that large metropolitan and urban sectors will benefit, where the current formula is already skewed and benefiting the larger municipalities because of the it's largely poverty, population and poverty driven. So for that's the reasons why the D component has not been introduced. It's basically that firstly there's no agreement on what form it should take, and secondly that some of the proposals that have been put on the table, such as roads funding, there's no available data to actually monitor that. For example, if you ask what is the length of road that's the responsibility of the municipality, and be it the local municipality or the district municipality, that type of information is just not available. As the system matures and more information becomes available, some of the proposals the FFC has put on the table will be considered and introduced. But some of the proposals at this stage is just not possible to introduce because of the lack of information. Then the last issue I think that's also important is also how does the grant system actually respond? And it specifically links to the consolidation of conditional grants. And that is, again, a complex issue. Everyone agrees that there's a need for consolidation. How is the question on how it should be done? If we look at one of the proposals currently on the table is that all conditional grants be consolidated into what they refer to as a single-purpose vehicle. And then be administered by one department. That's one option on the table. Another option is, just to give an example, currently if you look at water and sanitation infrastructure, you get the municipal infrastructure grant where 72% or 75% of the formula goes towards water and sanitation. Then if you look at the Department of Water Affairs, they've got the regional bulk system. Then if you look at the Department of Human Settlements, they've got the Rural Household Infrastructure Grant. And those programs do not necessarily talk to each other, which is a problem. For example, it does not help if you give a municipality through the Municipal Infrastructure Grant money for connector infrastructure if two situations are in place. For example, if the regional bulk, which then provides the resource to enable the reticulation provision, and you give someone reticulation money, but the bulk is not there, then it does not assist, because then you'll have reticulation or tap without any water coming through. And the other option, again, is that if you're far from rural areas and you're very, very far from any dam, for example, that can actually provide you with the water, and it will take many, many kilometers to actually just get some of the pipes in place, that type of system will not be appropriate. And for that reason, the Rural Household Infrastructure Grant has been introduced. So to some extent, some of these new grants have been introduced over the last few years to specifically deal with some of the gaps that you get in the general infrastructure grant money that's going to municipalities concerned. And it's most probably we need to look at it from that perspective, and there could be benefits in centralizing grants in terms of the sector. That could potentially also have options and possibilities, and I see the FFC is shaking their head. So that is the type of things that we need to consider going forward. The answer is not available yet, unfortunately. Thank you.
Mr. Kumalo.
Thank you. Just a few remarks on the presentation and some of the issues that that have been raised. I think, you know, it's very difficult for us, I think, in the past 3 or so years to actually interact as a commission with SALGA as an institution, because what has been happening is that there's a lot of interaction at a technical level between the commission secretariat and SALGA's secretariat. Now, as a result, what then happens is that we end up finding ourselves meeting at some of these forums with documents that maybe at some point deviate a bit from our interpretation of what our mandates are. For example, I find it very difficult to accept a situation where, or understand, let me put it that way, to understand a situation that requests that the commission, if you look at the slide that deals with the EDI, the commission should have provided in the report the financial and fiscal implications of the argument around the RES. That is really not the commission's mandate. If you go to the Financial and Fiscal Commission Act, and you look at what needs to happen from organs of state who actually want to do something or set up something that is of a nature of RES, where you set up an organ of state that will have be situated at one sphere of government but have financial and fiscal implications at another sphere of government. The Act clearly says that that organ of state basically is required to furnish the commission with the financial and fiscal implications on the relevant sphere of that function being shifted. Now, the commission must respond to that in no less than 90 days. And if the commission doesn't respond in no less than 90 days, it must actually indicate why it has not done that. Now, if you look at the evolution around this RED, and there's quite a couple of other issues that have actually happened that impact on the local government sphere, and we as a commission have not been alerted to some of these things. We basically pick them up because a municipality at some point has actually raised it as an issue, or somebody from the commission has just walked into a discussion and picked up that there's something like that has actually been happening. And so it becomes very difficult for the commission to deal with some of these issues, because if SALGA were to pick up some of these things, because what you're obviously raising here, if I can relate it to the 17th Amendment, bill, you will basically find that you're talking about now water, but that amendment basically related to a whole range of services that basically you still have to come back to this kind of a discussion. And that is why we do think that it's important, that it would have been important that obviously the Department of Minerals or Department of Energy would have been here to basically deal with some of those issues, because it's there, and it's those kinds of things that we have to deal with as a commission. And one would expect that SALGA, as part and parcel of where they are missing, what I hear is that SALGA is missing at the NCOP. As part and parcel of that, SALGA, being as close as it is to the commission, at least at that level of the secretariat, some of these things could be fed to the commission's work through that process, which is fairly established at that level. So it's very complicated. There are also issues here that are raised around the monitoring of the implementation of the Commission's recommendation. And I must say that in the budget process, SALGA is a critical player, not an observer like the Financial and Fiscal Commission. We are an observer in the budget forum. We will table our recommendations, and SALGA must process and must be part and parcel of the processing of those recommendations. And if government presents the kind of report, the annexure that you're talking about, Chair, that deals with the response of government to the Commission's recommendation, I make an assumption that SALGA is part and parcel of that response, because the response is prepared by the Treasury on behalf of everybody else that actually is an active participant in that forum. And therefore, the implementation must be of particular interest to SALGA, not to us to chase whether these are actually being implemented. And if they are not being implemented, then SALGA must actually raise it in that forum that these were accepted by government, but they have not been implemented. The issue around the equitable share formula, the development component, I take the point that we have not activated that, but I think Wendy has actually explained part of the reason why that has not actually happened, and for us, it remains an issue that must actually go beyond simple discussion. You know, people meet and share ideas, but there's nothing that actually comes out of it that says, no, okay, this is the submission that we are making to the people who are coordinating the process, that like in writing, that says we have conducted these exercises. And because at this point in time, those are all happening at a technical level. Now, as a commission, we haven't seen any movement around that since we made those recommendations. There's an issue that says the FFC must provide practical, I think it's like, unfortunately it doesn't have a number, but it's Chapter 3, Reforming the Local Government Equitable Share Formula 1. The last bullet point there. The last bullet point that says the FFC must provide practical solutions on how to replace the current RRC. Yeah, I would think that the review of the local government equitable share part of which SALGA, my understanding is that the technical team includes SALGA, COGTA, and the FFC. That would be an issue that basically should be on the table with that technical thing. So, Chairperson, I think I've said more than enough.
No, thank you, Mr. Kumalo. You raised a very important point here, that you and SALGA sometimes meet in a technical way, but you get together in a formal forum like this. Now, you've got time until 4 o'clock this afternoon when we come back to engage. You've got now the opportunity. You are here. That's how we operate in this committee. We do things like that. Here's your copy of the parliamentary program. I said immediately, here it is. You can take it. Until September, we'll supply you with the last term program when it's finalized, I think next week or the week after that. All the members, we deal with SALGA again this afternoon. We are now going to suspend the proceedings of this committee until 4 o'clock when we reconvene to deal with the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, as well as Rural Development and Land Reform. Thank you. All the members, we must be seated.